Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 24, 2018, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This afternoon, we are hosting a Courthouse Steps decision discussion on oil states following the Supreme Court's decision earlier today. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Professor Adam Mossoff, who is the founder and director of academic programs and senior scholar at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property and professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. With us is also Brian Pandya, who is a partner at the Wiley Ryan Law Firm. After hearing from our speakers today, we will move to an audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us. Brian, the floor is yours to begin.
Thank you, Wesley and Adam. Thanks for joining us on short notice. And thanks to everyone that has dialed in to talk about this interesting case today. And my name is Brian Pandya. I am a partner at Wiley Ryan in Washington, D.C., where my practice focuses on patent litigation. So the case we're talking about today is Oil States Energy Services versus Greens Energy Group, and this case dealt with the constitutionality of inter-parties review. Now, for the people on the call who are not patent lawyers or who aren't in the IP space, inter-parties review is a procedure that was created in 2012 by the America Invents Act that gave a body called the Patent Trial and Appeal Board the authority to hear and receive petitions that were filed by private parties challenging whether a patent was properly granted or not. The PTAB would form panels of three administrative patent judges, and if the APJs said there was a question of patentability that was raised by the petition, then they would institute an inter-parties review, and they would call the proceeding a trial, where certain evidence could be taken, arguments would be submitted, and then after an oral argument, the PTAB would decide whether to cancel claims or to confirm their patentability. This case was interesting because, it, like most IPR, or like most petitions for inter-parties review, this case, the IPR arose in parallel to district court litigation between two parties, here Oil States and Greens Energy Group. And what was interesting was that in the district court litigation, the court construed the claims, that is, that the district court said the claims had a certain meaning that was narrow, and that precluded certain invalidity defenses from being asserted in the district court. On the other hand, the PTAB, which takes the broadest reasonable interpretation of claims, said that under this interpretation, the patent claims were held invalid or unpatentable, as the patent office said. Oil States petitioned they appealed to the Federal Circuit. The Federal Circuit affirmed the PTAB. Oil States then petitioned to the Supreme Court, challenging the outcome of this case, but also arguing that the Patent Trial and Appeal Board is unconstitutional because it takes away property rights, here patents, without an Article III tribunal making the decision. And secondly, it violates the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial. Now, a couple of interesting things in this case. One of the key issues in this case was whether a patent is a piece of private property, like land, like your automobile, like any other real property that you own, or whether a patent is a public right, like a taxi cab medallion or a public franchise. And the analogies that were given in the decision related to toll roads, to bridges, to other franchises or rights given by the government for a private party for some ostensibly public purpose. And that was one of the main decision points in the case, because if a patent was found to be a private right, then it would almost certainly follow that the PTAB was an unconstitutional encroachment on Article III and on the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial. But as the Supreme Court found in the majority decision, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, that a patent is a public right, it's a grant of a public franchise, then it seemed to follow that the PTAB was okay, just as other agencies resolving disputes are able to do. So a couple things about this case. in the majority decision, which was a 7-2 decision, was Justice Thomas authored the decision. He was joined by Justices Breyer, Ginsburg, Kennedy, Alito, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Justices Gorsuch and the Chief Justice Roberts dissented. The Supreme Court first found that a patent was, in fact, a public right, not private property. The Supreme Court said was that because the grant of a patent arises between the government and persons subject to its authority, it's a public right. The decision to grant a patent is a matter involving public rights, specifically the grant of a patent, the grant of a public franchise. So that was the first decision that the first issue that the Supreme Court decided, and a couple reasons that it gave for finding that a patent was a public right rather than private property. First, that it's equivalent, it's akin to the grant of a franchise. It's like granting giving a right to build a toll road, a right to build a bridge. Secondly, the majority said that the rights to patents did not exist in the common law. The right to a patent is created by Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And then on that point, granting a patent is a constitutional function that does not involve the judiciary. Congress is authorized under Article 1 to grant patents. The Patent Office or some other part of the Department of Commerce or the executive branch has historically since the founding of the country been authorized to grant patents. The next argument or the next issue that the Supreme Court resolved was that it does not matter that an IPR happens after the grant of a patent because the grant of a patent is, at least since 2012, subject to review by the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. So just as the Patent Office can grant a patent, the Patent Office can take a patent away from a patent owner if the patent is invalid as anticipated or obvious in the condition in the context of an IPR or on other grounds in some of the other post-grant mechanisms. The Supreme Court also said that a patent can confer only the rights that the statute prescribes because it's a public franchise. So the fact that the Patent Office is giving the right to exclude means they can take the right away. Now, the last interesting thing about the case was that there was a lot of discussion in the majority opinion, especially in Justice Gorsuch's and the Chief Justice's dissent about this body in 17th century England called the Privy Council, and there was some discussion about whether what patent rights existed in England before the formation of the United States, before the Revolution. And the petitioner here, Oil States, acknowledged that while there was a Privy Council, which was formed by the King or Queen of England and had the right to revoke patents, their argument was that by 1787, the Privy Council had no longer existed or was largely out of commission in disputes over patents, which involved disputed facts, were resolved in courts, not by the Privy Council. The majority opinion, and I think some amici raised this point, that there were a handful of Privy Council determinations, and the Privy Council worked in parallel or in complemented some of the courts. So the conclusion they reached was that there was no common law right to a patent. There was no common law expectation that only a court could revoke a patent. Now, some things about this case. I attended oral argument back in November, and I'm frankly a bit surprised this was a 7-2 decision, and Adam's going to talk a bit more about that in a minute. But I felt that when I was at argument, there were at least five justices who expressed concern about the PTAB: Justice Gorsuch, Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Breyer. They raised, now my opinion was that it was not going to be, they weren't going to find five votes to find the PTAB unconstitutional. But I thought this was going to be a 5-4, maybe 6-3 decision upholding the constitutionality of the PTAB. But I thought I'm surprised that this was a 7-2 decision. Second related point, when I thought this case was going to be a bit like the Cuozzo case a couple years ago, dealing with broadest reasonable interpretation at the PTAB, the reviewability of PTAB institution decisions, And most of us patent lawyers looked at that case as a patent law case. How should claims be construed? But the Supreme Court summarily disposed of that case, or it was a 7-2 decision, but it really wasn't that close of a case that looked at it as an administrative law case. And so I thought this would also be seen as an administrative law case. And when you look at cases like FCC versus Arlington, where the Chief Justice and Justice Alito and Justice Kennedy raised concerns about certain administrative judges making decisions, I thought that 6-3 was the baseline. So the fact it was a 7-2 decision and really seen as more of a patent law case than an administrative law case was surprising, both from the tenor of the oral argument and from some of the earlier cases. But again, we can talk a lot about the case. I'll turn it over to Adam, who has a few a few thoughts on this case and some of the decisions that were cited in support of this decision.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be speaking today about the decision that was just handed down this morning, hot off the digital presses for many of us in our offices, in the Oil States versus Greens Energy case. As a general matter, it's a very surprising decision, if only for the very first time Supreme Court has held now that, as Brian has explained, that patents for new inventions are public regulatory grants on par with monopoly grants for bridges or toll roads. So, the inventor who toils away on an invention, or the company who spends billions of dollars on R&D in creating the next new radical technology like 5G or the next new pharmaceutical miracle, is being told that the fruits of their labors are being secured to them, not as the property rights that have long been secured under Supreme Court precedent, reaching back over 200 years, like all property rights in homes, farms, and animals, and other things. This is on par with the royal privileges that were granted by kings or queens in England, and thus what the government giveth, the government can taketh away, which is pretty much exactly what Justice Thomas in his majority opinion says. I wasn't surprised by the split nature of the decision as Brian described it. I've been paying attention to the Supreme Court's extensive amount of activity in the patent system of the past 5 to 10 years, where it is ruling on cases at a rate that we really haven't seen since probably the 19th century. And we have to also remember that was a time when the Supreme Court didn't have control over its docket, so there was no writ of certiorari, so it had to hear appeals. So that's why it was hearing so many cases at that time. And one of the reasons why the Supreme Court's been hearing the cases at this rate is because they really have been caught up in, for lack of a better term, what is a moral panic in Washington, D.C. that's been driven by millions of dollars in lobbying and extensive activism by organizations that have been pushing both the regulatory agencies, have been lobbying Congress, as well as engaging in extensive strategic litigation campaigns to convey the point that the patent system is broken. And we all know this because of the epithets that have now become common currency, like patent troll and other terms. And so the Supreme Court not immune to these activities, and they read in newspapers, and they live in D.C., and they hear all of this. So they've shown that they've been caught up in this. Justice Scalia, for instance, in one of his last opinions on the term in which he served in the Supreme Court, actually was one of the first justices to actually use the phrase patent troll in an opinion. So I always was of the belief that if they viewed this as a patent case, that it was going that they would rule in favor of the PTAB, that they would agree with the arguments that the patent system has problems, that there are so-called low-quality patents that are being issued, although that's largely an empirically unproven claim. It's more rhetoric than actual data-driven. And that they would therefore find that this is just a patent system quirk where the patent office issues patents and they sometimes make mistakes and therefore they have to be given the power to correct it. I was of the view that if they viewed this as an administrative state issue, if they viewed this as the growing regulatory overreach by the administrative state that we have seen over the past 10, 20, 30 years, as the administrative state now just reaches into every aspect of our lives and weakens all of the constitutional protections provided to U.S. citizens through the separation of powers, through the substantive protections of our rights to life, liberty, and property, and other matters, that this would be a much closer call, and it would be harder to decide, and maybe it might have been a 5-4 decision, very difficult to decide which way they went. But I'm actually on record saying that if they viewed this as a patent case, that that they would likely be a 7-2 decision at most, or a 6-3 decision, if being optimistic. And unfortunately, my realistic prediction came true with the 7-2 decision with Justice Gorsuch and Chief Justice Roberts joining him in dissent. As I mentioned, it is the first time that the Supreme Court has held as a broad matter that patents are kind of public regulatory grants, what are called public rights, and that they're on par with monopoly grants for bridges or toll roads. There are decisions by people like Chief Justice Taney in the 19th century who through dictum said things that are similar, but those were largely dictum. What drove the majority of the Supreme Court's decisions in this area and what drove legislation in this area was the view that patents, in fact, were not public grants, similar to the royal privileges bestowed upon English subjects by the crown, but like all other aspects in which the United States broke with England, that we secured patents, in fact, as private property rights. And thus, in the 19th century, they were provided substantive protections under the Takings Clause and the Due Process Clause, and many canons of construction, including very liberal canons of construing them in favor of patent owners, were applied, adopted from the canons of construction for title deeds. They were analogized to and had similar protections afforded under trespass doctrine. And most importantly, like all private property rights, they were secured in their commercialization through assignment and license in the marketplace. And that actually was essential, as economic historians like Zarina Khan and many others have explained, to the explosion in economic activity in the United States that we now identify as the Industrial Revolution, and which we refer today, 200 years later, as our growing innovation economy. And all of this now is called into question by this opinion that was just handed down, because it makes it very clear that patents are not vested private property rights secured to innovators, securing to them the fruits of their labors, as Justice Gorsuch referred to in his dissenting opinion, but instead that these are monopoly grants, as Brian said, similar to bridges and toll roads and other type of franchise grants that can be conditioned, changed, revoked, repealed, and whatnot, as they are, and that these thus become administrative playthings in our contemporary administrative state, where they will now suffer to the vicissitudes of the various forces that are brought upon the administrative state by various interest groups, and thus what we will probably see happen is that we will have a further weakening of the foundation of our innovation economy, because patents, as I mentioned, had been historically protected in this country as private property rights, and thus this served a very important role, just like all private property rights, providing a stable and effective foundation by which inventors, venture capitalists, and companies created the new products and services that have driven our innovation economy from the 19th century up till today. And all of this will start to be called into question as we see the creeping, growing administrative state now kind of go into the patent system, and these become similar to taxi medallions and other things that become just the mere playthings of public choice theory tells us of politically powerful interest groups and economically powerful interest groups that vie for them instead of securing new innovation. So that's my kind of opening remarks and my view on this matter. I'm as you can tell, I'm not particularly pleased with the decision. I was hopeful that they would recognize that the PTAB was, if anything, a bridge too far, in the administrative state, that Congress had created kind of an administrative monstrosity that was violating the rights of patent owners through extensive examples of violations of their due process rights and their substantive rights, as referenced in the dissenting opinion by Justice Gorsuch, but they did not, and I think that we will unfortunately be living with the consequences of the decision for many years to come.
Okay, well, if I can answer some of those or chime in on some of those comments. I mean, on the point of what's going to happen in the future, there were a couple sentences that particularly intrigued me, and take a look at the bottom of page 16 of the slip opinion, and I'll read these sentences. And it's, moreover, we address only the precise constitutional challenges that oil states raised here. Oil states does not challenge the retroactive application of inter-parties review, even though that procedure was not in place when its patents issued, nor has oil states raised a due process challenge. Finally, our decision should not be misconstrued as suggesting that patents are not property for purposes of the due process clause or the takings clause. So I think those are, I mean, when you look at some of the arguments that were raised in the briefs, the points that were raised by amici, how the oral argument played out, what some of the broader discussion has been happening in both private practice and in the academy, I think what the Supreme Court is saying here is that there are some challenges to the PTAB, but there are some questions that will need to be raised. You know, one of the more memorable exchanges at oral argument came back in November. And this was right after there had been some news stories, and I don't know whether these stories are true, but I mean, the allegations were that there was some panel stacking going on at the PTAB where the director or the chief judge of the PTAB changed the constitution of panels or added two judges to turn a 2-1 decision in one direction into a 3-2 decision in another direction. And again, those are the allegations. I'm just reporting what people alleged. And when some of the justices heard that, there seemed to be a bit of shock and concern. But I think the references to due process challenges suggest that if that continues, and if those allegations are substantiated, there could be challenges to the PTAB on those grounds. The question of retroactive application, I know that was one thing that I mentioned. Justice Breyer was one of the justices troubled by the PTAB. I mean, he raised the hypothetical, and I think he was talking about, I mean, he was presumably talking about a pharmaceutical product, but I suppose you could extend his hypothetical to any product that's protected by a patent, that if you invest 10 years in the patent and building up your product, is it fair to have an IPR filed 10 years later? Justice Kennedy also raised the point that, well, it may be true that for patents granted after 2012, there's an expectation that you can be subject to inter-parties review if a petition is filed and it's shown there's a question of patentability for earlier patents. Is that fair? So I think that, whether this gets back up to the Supreme Court, but I think there will be more litigation out the Federal Circuit, at least, over, I mean, this seems to be an invitation to challenge, to bring another challenge to the PTAB for patents that were filed before 2012, and if there are more panel stacking allegations, which again, I'm almost uncomfortable repeating the allegations without knowing the facts, but I mean, certainly the allegations were out there. If those allegations are proven true, I think that could be another ripe area. So I think you're being a little bit too pessimistic.
PTAB
are well known, but
Well, Brian, you're certainly right that there's going to be ongoing litigation. In fact, I was saying this in 2011 when I was on the Hill giving doing briefings for staffers about the AIA. I was opposed to the AIA, and I was telling them that the only people who are going to win out of the AIA are the lawyers. Because this is going to lead to massive litigation. I mean, we've already seen 3 Supreme Court decisions out of the AIA, and what oil states clearly conveys to us is we're going to see at least several more. And this doesn't count. The Supreme Court decisions that's just the tip of the iceberg. We already know that there's thousands of decisions before the Federal Circuit out of the PTAB, and there's thousands of cases at the PTAB. So this is just, this is not a good situation for innovators and for inventors. It is exactly what Director Iancu has been talking about when he's saying that we no longer have reliable patent rights that serve as the foundation for inventors to be incentivized to come up with their invention. And then for companies to take those inventions secured under property rights, patents, and take them into the marketplace. I'm less sanguine about what's going to happen going forward, because there is 200 years of precedent on what it means to classify something as a franchise grant or as a public right. I mean, this goes all the way back to Chief Justice Taney's decision in Charles River Bridge in the 1830s. which was on the specific question of whether a bridge owner, and by the way, this is what's significant about Justice Thomas's comparison of patent owners to recipients of bridge franchises, because the very first Supreme Court case on this issue was on the issue of whether people who receive a bridge franchise can apply for protections under both the Due Process or the Takings Clause of the Constitution. And Chief Justice Taney said absolutely not, that these are franchise grants, these are public regulatory grants that are not common law rights, and therefore they are abridgments of common law rights, and they're to be construed very narrowly against the grantee in favor of the public. And so we're just going to see a repeat of these same types of arguments, and Justice Thomas's own words are going to be used against him when these issues come before the court. And by the way, Brian, you're exactly right. You know, you have ongoing panel stacking. It occurred in the Erickson case at the PTAB. It occurred in the Mohawk Indian case. There is obvious and real concerns, due process concerns, about the operations at the PTAB. Unfortunately, that was not the question before the court. The question before the court was, is this a Seventh Amendment violation along with a violation of the separation of powers? And so they couldn't reach those issues. And that's why the expressions of concern about that during the argument didn't really give an indication of which way the court justices were going to rule, because that was not the legal question before them. But unfortunately, this decision that we now have in oil states really boxes in the justices who might be more inclined to find those to be violations when their own language is repeated back to them about how these are franchise grants, and franchise grants do not receive typical protections under the Due Process Clause or Takings Clause of the Constitution.
There was one another interesting sentence in the decision. It came on page 9 of the slip opinion, and it's it was the primary distinction between the setup to this is that the majority made the observation that the primary distinction between inter-parties review and the initial grant of a patent is that inter-parties review occurs after the patent has issued, but that distinction does not make a difference here. And here's the interesting sentence. Here's what they said. Patent claims are granted subject to the qualification that the PTO has, quote, the authority to re-examine and perhaps cancel a patent claim, unquote, in an inter-parties review, and they're quoting the Cuozzo decision from 2 years ago. Then they go on to conclude, patents thus remain subject to the board's authority to cancel outside of an Article III court. As I mentioned earlier, the fact that the majority found a patent to be a public right versus private property was significant, and once that decision was made, or once that viewpoint was accepted, the rest of the decision was in many ways predetermined. My reading of the majority's is the majority's decision is that because there is a statute that says the PTO can grant a patent and can take it away, that's a condition of taking a patent. That's really the central issue here. So that's why I said
in my opening remarks, the outcome in this case was determined by how the justices viewed the case. If they viewed it as a patent case, they were going to uphold the PTAB. Because of their views as to, you know, as expressed in Cuozzo too, the patent system has problems, and so obviously the patent office has the powers to fix those problems as the agency that grants patents. Or if they had viewed this as an administrative law case, as a case of the overreach of the regulatory state that has been incurring with increasing commonality in our lives over the past 10 or 15 years, as I've been mentioning, if going back longer, then it would have become a broader issue of and address a lot of the issues I think that were mentioned by Justice Gorsuch, right? That, you know, we have these we have separation of powers, we have, you know, due process protections, we have these types of protections, not because they're efficient, but because they secure people's liberty and rights. And that's a foundational principle. And we need to start kind of facing that principle, I believe, much more squarely. And we are going to have to face that principle much more squarely now that patents have been placed, squarely on the side of the administrative state.
Yeah, and I will say I am genuinely surprised that they viewed this case as a patent law case rather than as an administrative law case. I mean, I'm on record as saying, I've spoken at conferences and including last year at the East Texas Bench and Bar Conference, when I said I thought this case was a stalking horse for FCC versus Arlington. It's an administrative law case, and when I saw Cuozzo as an administrative law case, not as a patent law case, or at least the interesting patent law issues did not get a lot of play in that case. And so I thought that again, that's why I thought that this would be I never thought that the Supreme Court would find the PTAB unconstitutional for a variety of reasons I can talk about. I was also not expecting a 7-2 decision. I thought this would be 6-3, which was FCC versus Arlington, or maybe 5-4 with Justice Gorsuch replacing Justice Scalia. So that was I was surprised that this was, as you said, Adam, a patent law case, not an administrative law case.
Yeah. Maybe, Brad, I don't know if we have anything else to talk between ourselves, but it may be interesting to hear us take some questions from the audience.
Sounds good. Let's go ahead and open the floor to questions then. Looks like we do have now two questions waiting in the queue. Let's go ahead and turn to our first caller.
Hi, my name is Nathan Lowenstein, and I'm actually a PTAB litigator, and so I follow these cases with some interest. And I got on the call a little bit late, and I apologize if this is a bit off topic, but as of when I joined, I didn't hear you guys talk about the SAS Institute case, which from my parochial perspective is more significant of today's ruling. So I was wondering if you had any, if you had a chance to look at it, and if so, what your thoughts were.
Yeah, well, I took a quick look at the case, and if I can make a plug, the Federal Society is going to do a teleforum on that case, I believe, next week. So stay tuned and log in for that. But I thought that SAS actually was a surprising case, and from a practical standpoint, I do some work at the PTAB and as well as in district courts and the Federal Circuit. I thought SAS is actually quite a significant case. I mean, if you have a petition for inter-parties review that's granted on the basis of one claim being having a question of patentability, but now all the claims that you rate, including your petition, are going to be reviewed, I think there's a possibility. I mean, one thing to think about is, do these claims come out as patentable? I mean, you don't know where the board stands on the claims that they don't review in their institution decision. So I do think that was an interesting decision and a surprising case. And again, you never ever want to look too much into what happens at oral argument, but these two cases were argued on the same day, the Monday after Thanksgiving back in November, and in oil states was just buzzing with energy and discussion, and the oral argument at SAS was almost like the justices were looking out their watches and arguing about over what any means and differences between Section 314 and 318, and to have a 5-4 decision, which I'm still studying more carefully, but I mean, it was definitely a surprising decision, and I think from a client counseling standpoint, it'll be something we'll have to look at closely.
Thank you for your question, caller. Adam, do you have any thoughts on the case?
I must confess I haven't had a chance to read SAS yet, given the issues with oil states, of which I have been directly implicated in my research and scholarship, and I filed an amicus brief in the oil states case. So, but I'll be calling in to listen to the SAS teleforum next week on it, because as Brian just said, it's a very important case, especially now that we are moving forward with the PTAB as it has been operating up until now.
Thank you. It looks like we do have one more question in the queue. If anyone would like to join the queue, just enter the star key and then the pound key. Let's go ahead and move to our second caller.
Hi, this is Rob Randall. I'm a patent litigator. I also filed an amicus brief in the oil states case. And Adam, like you, I'm very disappointed. And I guess the question I have is, if Director Iancu is successful in the reforms that he wants to implement at the PTO, at least that appears that he wants to implement, is that our only hope at this point to strengthen the patent system? And specifically, the differences between the proceedings at the in an IPR versus Article III district court with respect to claim construction and presumptions?
Well, that is a great question, and I'll take the first stab at it, Brian, if you don't mind, since you answered the SAS question very well. And as a preliminary matter, it's important to recognize that now that the PTAB has been upheld as constitutional, and that patents have been defined as public rights by the Supreme Court, which will largely cabin in the scope and ability to continue to challenge the PTAB on a going forward basis. If you see takings claims or due process claims, they at best will have to be framed as applied challenges as opposed to facial challenges, because as the court held in Oil States, it's completely within the purview of the Patent Office and the administrative agency that it represents to create this type of tribunal and to create these types of rules. We're going to see a shift now in the debate to Congress, which actually a lot of the kind of legislative activity that one had seen in the patent space over the past several years, they hadn't produced much bills, but there was a lot of lobbying and there was a lot of effort to pass bills had been kind of held in abeyance while everyone was waiting for the Oil States decision to come down. And now that it has, we're going to see, I think, a renewed focus back on the Congress to fix the PTAB, right? So we're stuck with the PTAB now. I mean, ideally, it would have been held unconstitutional. The court didn't have to worry about invalidating other agencies and things of that sort, because the PTAB really has unique structures to it that other regulatory bodies don't have. But we are now going to face kind of a debate over how to reform this, how to stop the panel stacking, how to stop the abuse of due process rights in terms of, separating the decision to institute a PTAB decision from the people who actually then hear the administrative law hearing as to the validity of the patent, the ability to actually allow the statutory right to amend a patent to actually be put into effect, given the almost universal denials of motions to amend by the PTAB up to this date. And in fact, there is now legislation that's been introduced in both the Senate and the House called the Stronger Patent Act, which specifically is directed to these issues. And I fully expect that there will be some renewed energy about this. The Stronger Patent Act actually addresses a lot of the concerns that were raised in the oral argument, and they address a lot of the concerns that have been raised by Director Iancu. Now, Director Iancu has indicated that he understands these concerns, and it's a relief finally to hear the Director of the Patent Office recognizing and acknowledging that there are real concerns with how the PTAB has been operating, and that these concerns actually redound with negative effects upon inventors in the innovation economy, that they need to be addressed. But the problem is that we could have a new administration with a new director of the Patent Office appointed in 4 years, 8 years, 12 years, and we could go back to the original administration that we had before Director Iancu, where you had essentially an administrative tribunal running riot over the substantive procedural rights of patent owners. And so if we are going to better secure the foundations of our innovation economy, we really need to make sure that these rights are secured and that they're baked into the PTAB. So I fully support Director Iancu actually making administrative law changes and issuing new rules at the Patent Office to bring the PTAB in line with the typical protections that all property owners are expected to receive in the adjudication of their rights. But I think that we should talk more directly about the need to actually for Congress to amend the Patent Act to provide for these types of protections and bake them into the very structure of the PTAB, as well as addressing other concerns like the recent bad decisions by the Supreme Court on patentable subject matter under 101 and a reestablishing injunctive rights.
I agree. Thank you.
Thank you so much, caller. We have another question in the queue. If you'd like to join, just enter the star key, then the pound key on your phone.
Hi, this is Steve Meyer. I'm a litigator in the IPR process. And in fact, I was lead counsel in the NIDAC v. Broad Ocean case, which is cited in Gorsuch's dissenting opinion on the issue of panel stacking. And it seemed, in my case, there was an allegation of panel stacking, but there was no evidence of panel stacking, but it seemed like it was taken as a given. In that case, there was a 2-1 decision against us, in the institution decision with respect to one of the grounds. One of the grounds were granted, the other one was not. And then we filed within 1 month another petition that corrected the reason why the ground was denied. And we moved to join. And then we lost on that 2-1 on the issue of joinder, whether we could join ourselves. And it was contrary to the Target case. So then we moved for an expanded panel and relied upon the Target case. It was then 2 new judges were added, and it went from 2-1 against me to 2-1 in my favor. So there was then the allegation of panel stacking, but there was no evidence of panel stacking in that particular case, none whatsoever. So it seems that whenever there's a request for rehearing, given the odds of prevailing before the same panel, you try to come up with grounds for an expanded panel. And if you get that, and then the original panel is reversed, you're always going to be subject to allegations of panel stacking, regardless of whether there is any evidence in that particular case. And in fact, there is no, you can't, the parties would not be able to obtain any evidence to substantiate an allegation of panel stacking because it's internal to the board. So what would be the cure then to get rid of allegations of panel stacking, get rid of rehearing review on expanded panel? And if that's the case, the odds of prevailing on a request for rehearing are going to be even lower. So what do you propose for as a solution for allegations of panel stacking?
Well, I think that's a great question, Stephen, and I really appreciate you sharing the background on the NIDAC case that you were involved in and of course the other things you're doing with the American Bar Association on the PTAB space. This is me speaking in a personal capacity, not my firm, not our clients. One possibility is that, and this has been suggested many times before in different contexts, that the panel that makes the institution decision is a different panel that hears the trial or hears the determination on patentability. And in the same vein, it would make sense perhaps to have a different panel hearing a petition for reconsideration rather than an expanded panel. But if I can circle back to the panel stacking issue, that was one thing that I think kind of came out of the blue in oral argument, and my recollection of the chronology is right. The briefs were filed in the Oil States case before the so-called panel stacking allegations got in the news. And whatever the facts may be or whatever the circumstances may be, just that sounded unseemly and I think upset several justices, if not all of them. But it was not something that was on a developed record. But in fact, when Malcolm Stewart was questioned about it, the Deputy Solicitor General, who was just a fantastic advocate in IP cases, I think he wasn't even fully aware of the context of those allegations or what exactly was being alleged. So my reading of pages 16 and 17 of the majority decision is that if this is an issue, it is something that could be litigated or could be adjudicated in the future. But what exactly is the issue has to be determined in the first place. And as you said, this is a complicated issue. And if you ever want a petition for reconsideration to be granted, you're probably not going to move the initial panel. If it's the same 3 administrative patent judges. Now, whether that's best accomplished by an expanded panel or by a substitute panel or some combination of the two, I don't know the answer to that question.
Brian, I would say I would reject the factual claim because there is evidence of panel stacking because it's just what you're referring to as creation of expanded panels is panel stacking, and there has been evidence of that. There is evidence that a panel hands on a decision. 3 ALJs hand on the decision, and the chief judge said not acceptable, and added 2 more and re-decided the case. And then they re-decided the case, and then it came to the same decision, and the chief judge of the PTAB said not acceptable, and added two more judges to it until they came out to another decision with seven judges now on it. That is panel stacking. Now there, and it occurred in Erickson, and then they also preemptively stacked the panel in Mohawk, where Chief Judge Rushke said, it just added more judges even before they had the thing. This is what panel stacking refers to, because most, if you appeal a court opinion to an appellate court, you appear before three judges. And, no chief judge of an appellate court anywhere in this country gets to say, well, actually, we're going to put four judges on this panel now, or we're going to put five, or you came to a wrong decision, so we're just going to add two more judges. I mean, there's a process. Now the chief judge has said that the reason why the PTAB, the reason why he does this, and Chief Judge Rushke has written into the regulations of the PTAB his ability to stack panels without notification to the parties, that they need to do this to incur consistency between panel rulings. Well, that's a fine thing to appeal to if that's actually what they're doing, but you can create processes for doing that. Like, you can create what they have at appellate court levels, which is en banc rehearing processes and things of that sort. But what is occurring is panel stacking. It's changing of the panels because they want them to reach a different result than what they originally reached. And there's evidence for that. In fact, substantial evidence of it occurring.
Well, in my case, it just was the first time. And as I said, there was no evidence in my case. And it was just simply adding two judges. In fact, the case, the legal issue, there was only one case that supported the 2-1 decision against me. And the vast majority of the cases, all the other cases out there, were in my favor.
Yes. Well, no. So that's the example. That's the example of what you're saying, where they were trying to achieve consistency. But it's wrong to say that there's no evidence of panel stacking. I mean, there is, because they're
well,
it's, but you said more generally. So that's all I'm responding to. And because it is occurring.
If you, in that case, the widely held view was in my favor and against the 2-1 decision. So the odds are of picking any judges out of the 100-plus ALJs, you were likely going to get two judges that favored my view and were in favor of flipping the decision. Now, what would you propose, that you then sampled the judges to see what their opinion was beforehand?
No, you do what?
If you do randomly and they decide to flip based upon their own personal views, then the allegation of panel stacking can still be made.
Yes, because it's not the substantive outcome that matters. It's the fact that it's occurring, which is a fundamental due process problem. Fundamental. And as I mentioned, we address this exact concern you talk about in terms of consistency between panels and following past panel decisions already in place. It's called en banc processes, and they could create that at the PTAB if they wanted to. It's very easy. It's why we have an appellate process in this country. It's why you go from a district court to an appellate court to the Supreme Court. It's why we don't add six more justices to the Supreme Court if they happen to hand down a decision that contradicts a prior decision.
Okay, I was just going to say, there's another aspect to the standard operating procedures with respect to rehearing, that usually these requests for rehearing occur on the at the institution decision level. And if you have an expanded panel, the entire expanded panel stays with the case going forward. You don't go back from a five-judge panel to the original three. You stay with the five. So if you have an en banc case, you then have all 100-plus ALJs on your case, and it would bog everyone down. And
there's a much easier solution to this, which is that the director of the patent office identifies a set of PTAB ALJs, the chief judge, the assistant chief judges, six or seven others who serve as an en banc panel. That's all you need to do. And their composition is not changed based upon the case or the substantive result that you want to review or anything. Again, this is basic due process. This is written into the very structure of our government. This is why we broke from England, right? This is why we. This is the type of stuff that was occurring right at the Star Chamber in the 17th and 18th centuries, which became, right, which became the synonym for fundamental deprivations of basic rights, which is why we were breaking from England. And we're recreating the Star Chamber with these types of processes and these types of behaviors at the PTAB for patent owners. And in fact, it's even a better comparison because Justice Thomas says in his majority opinion that we're following British practices and that these are just like the royal privilege grants by the Crown, which is exactly what the Star Chamber viewed itself as enforcing.
I guess also what aggravates me a bit with respect to the citation to my case for panel stacking. As I mentioned, it turns out you have the five judges then going forward. In the final written decision on both grounds, it was 5-0 in favor of unpatentability. They were only a disagreement with respect to the legal issue, the construction of the regulation that allowed for joinder within the 1 month after an institution decision.
Well, that's, I mean, if I can interject and for a second here, I mean, I this debate is why I think there will be more challenges to the PTAB. There'll be narrower challenges. They won't be broadly questioning constitutionality of the PTAB, whether a patent's a public right or private property. But I do think that if the panel stacking issue is not brought under control, this is ripe ground for other issues. Now, I know we're almost out of time here, 3:00. I did want to ask one other question for Adam and anyone else who wants to chime in from the floor that's still with us. In sections 1B and 1C of the opinion, there was the history talking first about ex parte reexamination, then inter partes reexamination, then finally inter partes review, and all three of these procedures were lumped together, and kind of the implication was that if one was okay, all were okay. Now, one of the more interesting things, you know, again, to all the caveats about not looking into the argument too much, was that I think the first question asked at oral argument that Justice Ginsburg asked Allison Ho was, is there any error correction mechanism that is acceptable? And Allison Ho said that, well, ex parte reexamination would be okay, but inter-parties review is a bridge too far. So, you know, I'm surprised that, you know, that there wasn't more discussion of the distinction between IPRs, the previous inter-parties reexamination, ex parte reexamination. And Adam, I don't know if you have, you know, maybe this just is a function of the way the case was framed. They didn't have to make that distinction, but I was a bit surprised that there was no, you know, there wasn't more rigorous or substantive discussion of why, you know, just because ex parte reexamination is okay, which I think most people would agree, intra partes reexamination, I think most people would probably agree that's okay. You know, intra partes review, I think, raised some questions that were not answered, some challenges that were not answered, and I was a bit disappointed that there wasn't more analysis of that issue.
Well, we can have some. I have someone from the audience answer if they want to. I don't want to dominate the discussion. Wesley, if someone does chime in, will you just let me know? Will you interrupt me, please?
Sure. We do have one question waiting in the queue, but I don't believe it's for this question that's been posed.
Okay, I'd prefer
to take the question. Yeah.
Same here.
Okay. Okay. Great. Let's go ahead and move to this next caller.
Yeah, hi. So this is actually a second question for me. This is Nathan Lowenstein again. And Adam, I believe you're giving a very impassioned set of points about the Star Chamber and whatnot. And I just want to push back on that a little bit as the devil's advocate, which is that in reality, and, you know, I've litigated probably about 50 of these things, and I've also litigated a lot in district court. And I don't feel that I'm before the Star Chamber very much. I think comparing PTAB decisions with district court decisions
in patent matters, I think the PTAB decisions on average are probably better than your average district court decision. I think they're more involved. And by the way, also I represent patent owners in these things. So I'm one of the few litigators who represent patent owners who think pretty well of the process overall. And obviously there are decisions that we've had where we disagree with the board, but they tend to be on they don't seem tend to have the flavor of gross injustices. I mean, I think there are obviously lots of issues that can be objected to, you know, the fact that requests for reconsideration are basically never granted from the patent owner's perspective, the fact that the discussion you had with the other gentleman, the most surprising fact to me was that there was a split panel, because I think in 80 cases that my firm has handled, we'd never have had a split panel where everything is unanimous, which raises the question of to what extent are the judges really, you know, are they just pining off to one judge, or are they really disagreeing? But that being said, taking a step back, I do think the quality of decisions is pretty good, and a lot of district court cases don't proceed to juries. They sometimes get knocked out on 101 in the pleading stages, although I think there's been some pushback against that. I just wanted to get your reaction to sort of at least my limited perspective of the reality of these proceedings and how they go forward, and whether that affects your view of the broader administrative law issues.
Yeah. So no, it's a great question, and the point of the matter is I was making that what in the panel stacking, that's what is compared to the Star Chamber, because the fact of the matter is the Star Chamber was a prerogative court, and they did a lot of things that were perfectly fine as prerogative courts, and I'm fairly confident. In fact, I'm absolutely 100% certain that you will find lawyers who appeared many times before the Star Chamber on many other matters where they said the procedure was fine, they followed the law, they applied it, they were very good judges that I appeared before. I mean, that was the same with the Privy Councils and other prerogative courts before the Crown. So that's certainly the case. I mean, the PTAB has heard thousands of cases. I mean, clearly not every one of them is going to be rife with injustice. In the same reason that, you know, the English government itself, not every 100% of every one of its acts were acts of injustice, right? I mean, in fact, the Declaration of Independence lists a whole series of them. But a response by people in the Parliament, as well as some moderates or some people in the United States who were Tories at that time, or the colonies, I should say, you know, were like, yeah, but there are other things that the Crown has done that have been fine and have been good, and they've protected us as loyal subjects. And so, you know, so yes, you haven't experienced injustice in your 50 times that you've appeared. But the problem is that there are injustices, and the injustices are arising out of structural flaws. They're not accidents. There are flaws that are made possible when you don't limit the government in its agent in an agency or an organization or an official in their capacity, and that's why we have constitutional limits. I mean, because fact of the matter is that if you go ask Josh Malone, who's appeared before the PTAB, has he experienced substantial injustice in the invalidation of his very valuable patents by a very deliberate, willful infringer who has abused the system and has destroyed what has been a really important new innovation for children and around the world, and he has spent millions of dollars having to defend his patent, he'll say, yeah, this is I experienced serious injustice here. And that is the concern. And that's a legitimate concern, and that's the concern that I hope that the Supreme Court would have taken cognizance of. Although it was really, you know, the going back to Brian's question before we asked yours, right? I mean, the problem was that you know, because the case was coming before the court as a Seventh Amendment case, the nature of the structure of the arguments that they had to make, it was very binary as to whether the whole thing had to go down or not, because ex parte wasn't well, there's no jury either, and so you know, it was an unfortunate case. It would have been a much 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 better case if you had a due process or a straight separation of powers or a straight takings case had been brought before the court as the first case to test the constitutionality of the PTAB. It's unfortunate that it was actually a Seventh Amendment case, which forced the nature of the arguments into a much more narrow constrained path that, you know, really made it much more difficult for justices who would normally be inclined to hear and want to take into account the administrative abuses as reflecting a structural flaw with this agency, and prevented them from recognizing that.
Yeah, and I think that the argument was, in a way, it was underdeveloped here. I mean, one of the there was an exchanged oral argument. I think it was with Justice Ginsburg asking the question, but isn't ex parte re-exam or even intra partes, the old intra partes re-exam, that was involving, well, there was a petition filed by a third party, that was more or less between the patent office, a patent examiner, and a patent holder. So that was pretty similar to patent, to patent prosecution, patent application. Here you have a patent trial and appeal board, three administrative patent judges. You have a petitioner and a respondent, a challenger and a patent owner, and the answer was given was that the petitioner is just standing in the shoes of the patent examiner or the supervisory patent examiner that would have decided an intra partes re-exam or an ex parte re-exam. But I mean, I thought that was a distinction that wasn't developed, and would have been interesting to see where that would have led to the outcome of the case, because I mean, I do think there are differences between intra partes review and ex parte reexamination for sure, and even the old intra partes reexam in how the cases proceed, and that those distinctions were glossed over was a bit disappointing and unsatisfying in the outcome of this case.
Agreed.
Thank you, Adam and Brian. Would either of you like to give any final remarks before we end the call today? Looks like the top of our hour has come upon us.
I, for one, have spoken too much.
Yeah, well, I will. Well, I'll give one remark, and this is something I've said many times before. I mean, I think that the reason we have, if you look at what is the common thread of a lot of, whether it be Section 101 jurisprudence, the creation of the PTAB, some other cases that have pushed back at the problem of bad patents or that have created that tenor, is it's the fact that patent litigation is slow and costly and time consuming, and it's hard to invalidate a patent as being obvious. So the courts and Congress are looking for shortcuts, whether that be Section 101 cases or whether it be the creation of the PTAB as a way to get to an outcome that no pun intended is obvious, but is hard to accomplish in district court. And I think these are all symptoms of a bigger problem with patent litigation and frankly with civil litigation more generally being expensive and slow and time consuming and difficult to get to a decision that in many cases should be evident.
Thank you, Brian. So on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our experts today for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.